So greetings, everyone. I'm very happy to be here with you on this glorious day at the Menla Mountain Retreat, a wonderful spa, with Avalokiteshvara of the Thousand Eyes and the Thousand Arms behind me, icon, and plus Jivaka, who was Buddha's personal physician, Shakyamuni Buddha's statue of Jivaka, and then Yutoken Dengombo, who was the founder of the Tibetan version of Indian Buddhist Ayurvedic medicine. And so it's just a very auspicious place, and this is the same place where I gave my 12 talks on the 12 chapters of the Vimalakirti Sutra. And the Vimalakirti Sutra does connect very much with the Flower Ornament Sutra, or the Buddha Flower Ornament, or the Buddha Garland Sutra, as you might translate the Sanskrit title, because both of them have the title, the Inconceivable Liberation Sutra, and Achintya Vimoksha. And the Vimalakirti has it because it's considered to be like one drop in the ocean of the Flower Ornament Sutra. So it was the easier one to deal with in only 12 talks. To try to deal with the, to sort of expound and to relate to you something of the vision and the world and the reality of the Buddha's mind when he is giving the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, is like swimming, crossing an ocean by swimming. So never mind, it's impossible. But you know, they say that in the Vimalakirti Sutra, the Buddha says, when a bodhisattva wants to build a Buddha land, she or he does it only because it's impossible. And it's impossible in two ways. It's impossible because there are still even beings who are even in a Buddha land, they will refuse to be happy and they will cling to their suffering and they will create more and more of it sometimes. They kind of insist because the Buddha land does not invade their space and make them behave any certain way. Buddhas never coerce anybody. And so impossible in that sense, in that people, even though they're in a Buddha land, people will not all automatically react to being in a Buddha land and in an appropriate way. And people, beings, you know, or animals, different kinds of creatures. And it's impossible for the second way because everything already is a Buddha land. That is to say, reality, Buddhas live in reality. And reality, everything is perfect. And you don't even need a body to enjoy that. And you don't need trees or gardens or anything. You know, you can just be in pure, unconstructed bliss, which is a vast field of clear light of the void, they call it. So that's okay, but so it's impossible to build because it's already there. And so that's the second reason. There's always two reasons. And Buddha shows that in the Vimalakirti by challenging Shariputra, who wonders how there can be a Buddha land, Shakyamuni's Buddha land can be a Buddha land, because he looks into this world that we live in, the one we think we live in, here on planet Earth, which they call the Saha world, the Saha Buddha land, tolerable Buddha land. And he thinks this is very imperfect. How can this be a Buddhaverse? And then Buddha challenges him, puts his toe on the ground, and he suddenly sees everything as perfect. And he feels that he himself is a piece of the perfection within perfection. And they put that in terms of everything is envisioned as made of jewel plasma, of kind of preciousness, you know. But not a little bit misleading to us, perhaps, because we think of jewels as little hard things that you couldn't digest, like little gems, you know, crystals. But actually, a jewel plasma universe, everything is alive, and everything is vibrant, and everything is ecstatic and orgasmic, and yet everything also has its form, sort of, but it's transparent to the bliss. So in that sense, it's the inconceivable liberation is impossible because it's inconceivable. And so that's what the world of the Avatamsaka is like. Why am I embarking on this? Well, People have asked me for some time to do it, and I've wanted to, but I know it's such an imposing job to do, try to take up this entire sutra. And be nice to do in this lifetime. So I want to do it. And then, just recently, my dearly beloved friend, although we did not see each other in the last, I'd say, 10 years of his life, maybe a little more, 15, because, I don't know, he was ill, and I didn't get out to West Coast, and whatever. He got into a mood, very remarkable person, very eccentric, always did his own things, who translated the flower ornament scripture, a translation of the Avatamsaka Sutra. And which is short form. Avatamsaka means a garland, actually. And so Huayen in Chinese becomes flower ornament. And literally. But what kind of a flower ornament? A garland, like a lei that you get when you go to Hawaii. That's an Avatamsaka. And this is an Avatamsaka called a Buddha Avatamsaka. So that means it's a garland made of Buddhas. So they're all, every atom in the garland, in the flower ornament, is a Buddha. There's a Buddha universe in every atom. So every atom in the chair, the couch in front of me, my computer, the book, my own body, your body, any airwaves or transmission lines in between us, every single one, it has universes in every subatomic particle. And in those universes, there are vast Buddha lands. And they are ultimately Buddha lands, actually. And every single, therefore, atom has everything of every other atom in the world, like a hologram. You know, a hologram, you have a plate of a hologram, and you put a light through the plate, and it produces a three-dimensional thing, and laser light through it. And but if you break the thing and put the light through one other part of it, the whole picture comes from each part, although it's more redundant when more parts are there. So that's the nature of a hologram. So the sort of overriding image of the Avatamsaka Sutra is the jewel net of Indra, which is Indian mythological thing, where in the Olympus city, which is called Sudarshana in Sanskrit, of where the gods live of the old Vedic pantheon, the Indo-European Vedic pantheon of the Indian mythology, there is a net of jewels that hangs over the city, sort of everywhere in the city. And so anyone, any god who wants to look in it, who's hanging out in the city, partying, whatever they do, occasionally they go study, but the Buddha goes there and they have to study. And occasionally they have to go out and make a war with the Titans, just temporarily. And but they look in that one facet of one of the jewels and they see all the other jewels and everything else that's going on in the city. So it's like the ultimate Facebook city, you could say. Every information is everywhere in the city. And so that's the sort of the jewel net of Indra, king of the gods, he's the Zeus of the Indian Olympian gods, on top of the cosmic mountain, and which is one of the heavens of the desire realm. So that's what the image is. All right? So now the great... There was a great Chinese. Oh, anyway, yes. And I was saying, my friend Tom Cleary passed away, and so it's in honor of him. And in fact, the story of his translation of this book, which he did from the long version, Chinese version, it's about 1,600 pages, the book. And he was persecuted by academics during his lifetime, and they tried to act and pretend like that he didn't know what he was doing and so on. Again, he didn't have footnotes in this translation. And also they were jealous because he translated so many things, not only Buddhist things, Taoist things, Confucian things, whatever he was interested in, even Muslim things in Chinese or Japanese. He was the greatest translator of our generation from Chinese and Japanese. There's absolutely no question about it. Thomas Cleary. And he and I were sort of classmates. He was younger than me, actually. But we were sort of classmates at Harvard. And our professor there said that of all the people that he had ever taught in 50 years of teaching at Harvard, Thomas Cleary was the greatest translator, had the greatest control of Chinese and Japanese, including colloquial idioms from thousands of years ago. He somehow had an intuitive ability to translate it in an extraordinary way. And I would put it that he was reincarnation of some great Chinese or Korean or Tibetan or Japanese translator who, you know, made a vow centuries ago, millennia ago, to always try to translate into all languages Buddha's teachings. In eras where there was no living Buddha evident who had the power to speak in one voice, and yet people hear him in many different languages simultaneously, which is one of the uncommon powers of a Buddha, of a perfect Buddha when they're in their perfect Buddha form, their supreme incarnation body form. And so he was really, but he was a very sweet and dear person also, Tom was. He was so kind and sweet and nice, handsome, wonderful Irish-American bloodline he incarnated in. And he was just marvelous, you know, great poet himself, you know. So anyway, in his honor, I'm going to embark on discussing this. Okay? Now, the other thing is that there was a great Chinese master who was inspired by Manjushri, who was a bodhisattva of perfect wisdom and perfect eloquence, who in what was called the Jingko lineage, the golden speech lineage, in Tang Dynasty times in China, 7th century, and 6th, 7th century. And he said that this sutra was the first thing Buddha taught upon enlightenment, and that he taught it all over the world, actually, and in a time-distorting manner. During the first 49 days, the first two-thirds of it he taught during the first 49 days of his post-enlightenment time. And his normal humanoid, human-level physical body was present in the grove under the Bodhi tree where he attained enlightenment, attained his final moment of enlightenment in that human life, humanoid life of the last life as a bodhisattva. And But then he taught the sutra, though, in not so much in the human realm as in all the heavens of the desire realm, so that the different chapters of the sutra were taught in Tushita or in Paranimitta Vashavartin or in Yama, in one or the other of the heavens, or in the heaven of 33 or so on, as they are called, the different heavens. And so they were taught to the gods, actually, primarily, before he went to deal with the humans in the human realm. And then about two-thirds of the way through the sutra, as it was collected later, initially by the Nagas, by the dragons, the Buddha had them collecting and preserving the sutra under the ocean. And then he said because he wanted to keep it private in India, he taught it originally to the monks, he retaught it to them, all the Mahayana sutras, but then he said he didn't want them spread in the country for about 400 years. Because the monastic order, the bhikshu mendicant order, had to be well established in the country. Sort of like, in other words, there had to be 10,000 menlas, places where people could go on retreat, and actually lifelong retreat in that case, because it was a more wealthy economy for the number of people present at that time. India was the richest place in Eurasia, which is why Buddha went there. And because they would be tolerant of people doing that. It took a long time to change the economy of India, where people had the idea that the individual could attain this highest level of life of Buddhahood. And they at first didn't really think that the Indian system was like a monistic hierarchical system where, you know, you had your upper caste people, the priests and the warriors on top, and then the priests who served the warriors and who maintained the sort of propaganda, the spiritual tradition that it was all one. And then the lowest people also were all one with those highest people. So there was no incentive for the lower ones, the geniuses among them, the bodhisattvas among them, those who had the possibility of becoming enlightened in a human life. There was no individualistic possibility for them to rise from their low caste preoccupations. And even the Brahmins had to just do rituals all the time. And so because there was no place to go because you were in the one place. So that's monism. And he didn't want the non-dualism of the Mahayana to be conflated with that, confused with that, and used as another way of saying, well, it's all nirvana, it's all perfect, and the clear light of the void, everything here, so you don't need, you can just clean the latrines, you can, and, or you women can stay down and just bear children and cook the food and weed the gardens and so on. And we'll just sit around. You know, but we're all one. So you shouldn't worry about feeling you're in a lower place. So Buddha didn't like that. And so he wanted people to be free and as individuals, and then they would create greater freedom in the collectives. So he needed 400 years of people dropping out of that monistic hierarchy, finding the higher space of nirvana, even if they initially thought it was some other place. He didn't mind that, because they'd soon discover that there was no other place. He told them that in hinting already, but he wanted them just to know that. They had to discover it viscerally in order to avoid our escapism, because we're all like that, we like to escape. After teaching the gods, he then shared the recording of that teaching with his monks, but then he said no one else can do it. Then the last third of it, called Entry into the Realm of Reality, sort of gives the example, starting with book 39 in the sutra, it gives the example of a human being encountering the world of the Avatamsaka. And that goes on from page 1135 to around page 1590 or something, 1600. And what that is that someone like us, like a yuppie Indian kid called Sudhana, who is a banker's son or a merchant's son. And he goes around and he meets 52 different teachers around India. And the different ones give him one of the samadhis or one of the meditative realizations, one of the wisdoms, one of the levels of wisdom that the Buddha taught the gods and all the sort of celestial bodhisattvas in the first two-thirds of the book. Because he teaches not only 10 stages. There's a famous sutra, part of this one, called the 10-stage sutra that we will discuss at length. But there are actually 52 stages, not just 10. And those 10 are stage 31 to 40. And then there's 41 to 50, and then 51 and 52. And then there's 1 through 29, or 1 through 30, which are preliminary stages from any ordinary person where they begin. So this idea of a kind of ladder or escalator that you go up to change from being a self-centered, unenlightened, suffering being to becoming a fully enlightened being. So that, in other words, everyone can get on wherever they can, and then there's a well-organized path for them to go on. And Buddha had to create a thing like that because Buddha was unable to simply tell someone, this is enlightenment and now you're enlightened if you believe it. Because it doesn't work like that. You have to imagine it. And you have to recognize that where you are is not cool, even if you're in a sort of relatively pleasant situation. And you have to note that that's not as good as it can be. And you have to, you have to sort of work your way toward it. And you have to personally experience it yourself. You have to open your mind yourself. No one can force it open for you. In fact, anything that they do that tries to force you, you will close it more because you don't like being forced, because you're basically, you've gravitated by being human toward freedom, actually, in an evolutionary sense. Okay? So that's sort of, that's a little bit introduction to the Avatamsaka. Now I will read from the beginning of the sutra. And remember, this sort of, although it's 1,100 pages long in English, and the long Chinese version was from the longest collection they could of the Sanskrit versions that circulated in India. We should also say one other thing, and that is that written texts were not happening in Buddha's time for spiritual things in general in India, although he encouraged people to write them down, contrary to the Vedic tradition where spiritual things you knew by memory. And they were transmitted by memory, and people had these incredible memories. You know, they had hard disks in their brain, and they could remember hugely. And Buddha's listeners included what you might think of as idiot savants, who would repeat it, whatever he had said for 2 hours or 5 hours or 8 hours, and they would repeat it for the next 8 hours without missing a single beat or a single word. And I witnessed something in the direction of this in India from the Tibetan exile lamas who were educated in Tibet, and they would recite, you know, 500-page book, just bang like that, and you would be turning the pages. And you could, it was exactly accurate what they would, in fact, they would have a better reading than some of the printed books that you have nowadays. In some case, you know, if you slowed down to check it, there'd be a typo or something, and they would accurately recite it. And so that was the fact. So therefore, sutra, it is said when a Buddha does talk, it puts the listener into a state of meditation. Because the sutra collection in the Buddhist collection or baskets of texts are the collection of meditations. And when he would speak, you would go into a meditation, and his following the voice, you would be realizing certain topics. But not just by believing what he was saying, but they would just create, that's the way he would share his vision. And you could sort of climb into that if you had the concentration. And, you know, his stories about the Buddha were known as the Vinaya, and they would teach you the ethical way of living by example. And then the systematic ordering of the different themes in the Buddha's teaching, like in more systematic than his own actual speech, because he always organized things in terms of whoever was listening to him, whatever they needed, wherever they needed to enter, he would be completely, because he was totally empathetic. Because the Buddha is a being who is completely 100% empathetic with every other being. That's the nature of a Buddha. And so he would be very accurate as far as leading them in the area or placing them in the zone within their own minds where they would be most able to develop deep transformative insight and have a kind of a rebirth at a new level of experience. And so that's what sutras are. And therefore, when they're written down, they are recording the type of atmosphere he created, meditative atmosphere that he created to a certain degree, but in a completely different context. So therefore, there's the third level, which is the wisdom level, where it's like scientific manuals, and it's giving you structures of thought which enable you to access new zones of experience, something like that, you could say. All right? So in this long 1,100-page thing is some sort of like a trace, you could say, of the space that he created in the 49 days after he was enlightened, a Buddha, and for the huge assembly of beings that showed up to celebrate that enlightenment in the grove there on the human plane. I mean, the connection to the human plane was being in the grove in Bodh Gaya. But there were beings at all celestial levels and from all galaxies and universes, also other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who would come and so on. And, you know, it's an unbelievable dramatis personae, you could say, in this sutra. Incredible. And in a way, one of the visions I like about the Avatamsaka, when I read the Avatamsaka, you know, you get into a different cosmology immediately when you read it. Because what is our cosmology? Well, maybe we're sitting in a nice place in the mountains of the Catskills, on the East Coast, in the Hudson Valley rainforest. And we're comfortable and it's warm weather and we're in a beautiful retreat place and so forth. So we think that's kind of fun. But then our larger thing is, oh, we know there's all those highways out there. There's all these terrible insect realms and beings that are suffering. There's slums and human realms. People, there's other countries where there's famines and wars and people are bleeding and there's hospitals here where they're suffocating to death and so on. And then the whole thing is on this planet that is whirling around at 24,000 miles an hour at the equator and some other speed at different latitudes. And then there's it's zooming around in a dark, cold, empty space where there's no pressure and you'd explode if you didn't have a spacesuit on. And then then Mercury and Venus are uninhabitable, and so is Mars and Jupiter, and we're all just like lost in space. And the sun is blazing, and eventually it'll blow up, and then it looks like there's nobody else anywhere ever, and just a few of us, humans, a few billion of us, and we're on this little skin of this thin soil over burning magma and drowning oceans, and like the air that can be so badly polluted that it's completely debalancing the whole thing, and then you're up out of the air with a little bit of a rocket. And it's a horrible, lonely, like inimical to life sort of place. In fact, actually. And we're told that's all there is, and we're just material quantities within it, worthless sort of nothing beings. And we only temporarily think we're here, and then we're temporarily having a pain, or we temporarily have a moment of pleasure, and it's gone. And it's all meaningless and pointless and whatever, you know. And it doesn't even exist, really. Just a bunch of rocks banging around. So that's our cosmology, and therefore naturally our greatest product, most popular product, is tranquilizers and mood-altering substances that make us not be aware of where we are, so then we can relax. Sort of anticipate the nothingness that awaits us, and that we really are. That's our cosmology, okay? Of the mind. No wonder we're wrecking everything, and just trying to grab for some moments of bliss and pleasure, you know, in between the hopeless situation. But the Buddha's cosmology is far from that. Everything's teeming with life. Every rock is alive. Every rock has huge life realms within it and billions of happy beings. And there are some beings insisting on suffering, but the happy ones know how to help them get out of there. And they do, sooner or later. But at any different one cross thing that you do, you if you don't understand, you will see a lot of suffering ones. And that's part of being able to get out of it. You have to be aware of that. So you find out how to do it properly. And so everything is teeming with life, and there's a billion other humanoid planets, because the human form is particularly precious, not because it's better than other forms, just sort of abstractly, in some sort of abstract measure of value, but because the human can become a Buddha form. And then becoming a Buddha, they can then help all those other forms that are not able to so easily, because they don't have the language, they don't have the degree of freedom that the human being has, or they have too much kind of meaningless freedom, like in the God realms, you know, where they just like mess around, because they become deluded and think they'll be there forever, and that they'd forget there's any other beings in any other situations. And so that's why the human is precious, because a human can become a Buddha, who's the one who's really precious, who's able to help everybody. And the Buddha can then again become a flower, can become a planet, it can become any tree or anything. So Buddha is everywhere, the life, because it's very close to, and it is the life force. Buddhahood is the life force. It's when you become same as the life force, and yet out of the life force you can manifest whatever benefits other beings who are trapped, who feel they're trapped in the life force. Or they feel there's a death force stalking them and they're frightened and so on and so on, which is an illusion, actually. Okay? So that's the world. So the world of Avatamsaka, therefore, when Buddha becomes enlightened, when a human being becomes a Buddha and sort of joins, then everything focuses on that being. And that being, it's sort of the being who has suddenly become one with all other beings. Then those beings that already feel they're one with all other beings particularly congregate around to celebrate that they have a new member of the team. and then they so all reduplicate and redouble their effort, which is effortless effort. You know, it's infinite effort to bring everybody else into that fold, you could say. You know, which, because each one has to decide themselves they want to join it, so they have to only appeal to them through their own free reason, their own free experience, and it becomes a huge, the ultimate Hollywood. Hollywood, it becomes. Okay? So anyway, thus did I hear on a certain occasion, now I'm going to read from it. Thus did I hear on a special occasion, and this is a special occasion, and these little minuscule efforts of mine to share with you and to open, to turn you on to the reading this otherwise incomprehensible stuff. Swimming in this sutra. Swimming in the Buddha's mind is like some trace, some doorways. Every word is a doorway into a Buddha's mind. And it's a special occasion. because it's something utterly wonderful. And in fact, the first book, in the way that this version, which was originally a Sanskrit version, translated into Chinese by Shikshananda, and then into English by Thomas Cleary, in an unheated apartment in Osaka, in his wife's in-law's unheated garage apartment, where the only heat was under a table. What Japanese have a little thing where there's a heater under a table in some cold place. And he would have to put his fingers in there to loosen them, and then he could type for a while, and it was so cold. And he did that. And another day I'll tell you, we started together actually here in the Catskills. I started the third section, not this one. Okay. So thus have I heard, or thus did I hear on a special occasion. The Buddha was in the land of Magadha, in a state of purity. That's sort of Bihar nowadays. And Bihar, by the way, in India means a monastery. Bihar, a dwelling, a residence, but it meant a mendicant's residence, a vihara. And the whole state has that name because there were so many of them in the Buddha's time and for 1700 years later, until they were all destroyed about 1,000 years ago. In a state of purity, at the site of enlightenment, having just realized true awareness, Tom's translation, you know. Evam maya sruttam ikasmin samaye. So, wonderful. I like it. In a state of purity. The Indian word for perfection is purity. Because they were very cleanliness oriented. In their wonderful well watered plains. The Ganges plains, the Indus plains, and this sort of thing. At the site of enlightenment. Having just realized, he calls enlightenment true awareness, meaning the awareness of reality, because this extraordinary cosmology and cosmos is the real one, and the realer one, let's say, and the one we think we're in, and this body, this very imperfect body, and this really sort of semi-imperfect environment, as nice as it is a kind of illusory, actually. And it isn't the real reality. The ground was solid and firm, made of diamond, adorned with exquisite jewel discs and myriad precious flowers with pure, clear crystals. The ocean of characteristics of the various colors appeared over an infinite extent. There were banners of precious stones, constantly emitting shining light and producing beautiful sounds. Nets of myriad gems and garlands of exquisitely scented flowers hung all around. The finest jewels appeared spontaneously, raising inexhaustible quantities of gems and beautiful flowers all over the earth. There were rows of jewel trees, their branches and foliage lustrous and luxuriant. By the Buddha's spiritual power, he caused all the adornments of this enlightenment site to be reflected therein. The name of this chapter is The Wonderful Adornments of the Leaders of the Worlds, because Buddhas are the leaders of the worlds, whether we recognize them as Buddhas or not. It doesn't mean that, unfortunately, nowadays, that the leaders of the worlds are Buddhas, if only. But unfortunately, some of them are all too egotistical. But the opposite of a Buddha is completely selfless. Although they can manifest a being that appears to us to be like an ordinary being in order to communicate with us, because we only expect to be communicated with other beings who are like us. But they are actually utterly selfless. They are, their own awareness is an infinite field that knows everything by being all of it, if you will. Self-communicating, self-aware, self-enlightened, true awareness field. That's what Buddha means. Buddha means blossomed into awakening from the sleep of self-centeredness and also expanded into enlightenment of knowing everything about everything. That's what a Buddha is. And by knowing everything about everything, one realizes the lovability of everything. And so it's a being also of what we would call perfect love, in the sense that it knows beings who feel unloved, who feel sort of partial, who feel alienated or separated from life, and they feel that death is actually stalking them, and that others are seeking to harm them, and others are not doing what they want, and others don't like them, and the others are dangerous, and so on, so on, so on. And so a Buddha perceives such a being the way they see themselves, completely empathetically, but they simultaneously see them as completely bliss, made of bliss, like a configuration of a bliss energy. And so they know that they will be able to discover their actual reality, but they need the kind of reflections, like a mirror, images, that show that deeper level of their being. That's what they need. And this then releases them gradually. They can gradually feel safe enough to open their paranoid self-boundaryingness, their self-limitation, to open to their actual deeper way of being. And so that's what Buddha's automatically, their presence automatically does that. And we touch on their presence by reading this, and by which is the trace that we have left to us. And although it's imperfect in the sense that, you know, scholars will show there's different versions, different texts, one is longer, one is shorter, et cetera, et cetera. They're going into that. We do that as a scholar. But whatever trace it is, depending on how open we are, we can find something in it. And thus the tremendous value of these things. The tree of enlightenment was tall and outstanding. Its trunk was diamond. Again, this diamond. Now, again, when we hear diamond, of course, we think of, when we're looking at a diamond, it sparkles and it reflects everything in itself. And it has like a kind of eerie brilliance about it, although it doesn't shine in the dark on the human level. But in the divine levels, in the sort of deeper cosmic level, diamond is the symbol of this infinite energy that is more, can never be broken or separated. It is the inner clear light of the void. But it's also completely soft, and it gets out of the way, because it doesn't obstruct anything. It is, in fact, the life force of everything. And even it's the force, the structure force, material force in material things. It's everything. It's what that diamond is. So everything is diamond, in the sense that you never can leave it. You are it, and it's perfect. So that's what diamond means. It doesn't mean like a hard thing. They use the crystallized diamond, which is what comes from extreme pressure in the bowels of the earth, that it takes a piece of coal, carbon, and it crushes it into, by putting super pressure, it becomes diamond. And then we think of it as something hard, because it's separate from us. But the hardest thing is transparent, actually, is its transparency. And so everything is like that. It's impossible. It's infinite hardness, and like its softness of water, a softness of air, you know, simultaneously, the clear light of the void, as it's called. And we're made of that. And in art form, it's sort of soft. It's skin and things, but there's some hardness. There's bone and things in it. But it's all of it is clear light of the void. All of it is diamond, actually. It's what we understand when we become a Buddha. Anyway, the tree of enlightenment, so its trunk was diamond. Its main boughs were lapis, lazuli. Its branches and twigs were various precious elements. The leaves spreading in all directions provided shade like clouds. The precious blossoms were various colors. The branching twigs spread out their shadows. Also the fruits were jewels containing a blazing radiance. They were together with flowers in great arrays. The entire circumference of the tree emanated light. Within the light there rained precious stones. And within each gem were enlightening beings. Enlightening being is Tom's translation of Bodhisattva, which I do love, although I want to say enlightening hero, or even Shiro, the feminine of hero, or my preferred feminine of hero rather than heroine, Shiro. I like that. So enlightening Shiro, I would like to say. But sattva, the word bodhisattva, sattva part of bodhisattva, it can be bissa being. But I like Shiro anyway. Enlightening Shiros, heroes, in great hosts like clouds, simultaneously appearing. So each gem, first of all, the gems are within the light. So the circumference of the tree emanated light. But then the light rained, was a rain of precious stones. then the precious stones contain clouds of enlightening beings. So you see all categories of things that shouldn't be able to contain each other are completely fused in this kind of thing. But then light is what's streaming through it all, and multicolored light. But even the multicoloredness is a differentiation within it. And it's all kind of this like crystal light. It's diamond light, actually. It's clear light light. It's clear light light. So imagine, since you are light, you don't see light. It doesn't seem bright to you because it's the same as you. So the light is not something registering on something less light. Do you follow me? So, and yet, then when we do that, people think of the clear light of the void as if it's just empty space. But it isn't empty, it's all the things in the space and the empty are the same thing. Okay? That's the thing. And for example, the modern scientific analysis of matter, where it gets down to atoms, molecules, you know, then atoms, then subatomic particles, then, you know, and you know, the model of an atom, right, that they popularly say in science class in the fourth grade or something, is a little flea on home base in Yankee Stadium, and then another flea in the bleachers, in the farthest bleachers, is the electron going around the nucleus, and most of it is empty space even inside the atom. And then when the quantum people 100 years ago smashed into the atom more and more, they got where they, even inside this subatomic particle, it was also infinite empty space, etc. And finally, you know, they got lost in there. And their minds, they became aware of their own minds in there. And they said that our minds being there through our electron microscopes, or through our laser or explosion cyclotrons or whatever it was, they are interfering with whatever there seems to be like a matter here. So therefore there's nothing objective in here, actually. And they sort of sailed into empty space. In a way, but without being able to verify why they didn't feel they were in empty space. So in a way, they through deep investigation, even though they were bound in the materialist idiom and the materialist dogma, they still discovered it, the clear light, in fact. 100 years ago, they made an announcement in 1926. And then the more ones who were more wanted to cling on to matter freaked out, and there's been confusion reigning ever since, because they weren't content to let it be illusion, let it be illusory or like illusion. Because once everything is like illusion, then it's real at that level, and you have to take it seriously, you know. So but when you know it's illusorily real, it becomes more transformable, and you're more free in your way of interacting with it. And then you can therefore be only benevolent in your interaction. So that it's sort of a chain of insights like that. That they did achieve, our own materialist scientists achieve it, and then ran away from it, most of them. Because it was scary. They felt lost in space. They felt lost in space. So I love that. The entire circumference of the tree emanated light. Within the light there rained precious stones. And within each gem were enlightening beings in great hosts like clouds simultaneously appearing. Similarly, for example, just you can immediately think E equals MC squared, you know. That is to say that the reason for materialists that the speed of light is an absolute, encasing Einstein's theory of relativity, meaning that everything is relative and there is no absolute. But the absolute is the speed of light. And why? Because speed of light, at the speed of light, mass or matter becomes infinite. So therefore light is already everywhere, in fact. That's the absolute. So all this matter, for all of the dogma of matter, it's just all light. Because all light is at its all natural speed. It's everywhere. So anything that seems dark is our confusion. Because it's all light. Okay? Even darkness is light. It's dark light. So we have all these clues in our own seeming reality patterns to begin to use this to have our imagination expand, to see the light in the dark and the dark in the light, to see the gem in the water and the water in the gem, to see the living being, the alien living being, even the bodhisattva from other dimensions and universes in this universe, in the gem, inside the gem, thousands, clouds of them. The universe is full of them in this one. The way we, and yet treat it our own way. Do you follow? That's what we're doing. Also, by virtue of the awesome power of the Buddha, the tree of enlightenment constantly gave forth sublime sounds, speaking various truths without end. Next time you hug a tree, see if you can hear sublime sounds in the tree, the voice of the tree talking to you. The palace chamber in which the Buddha was situated, oops, he's suddenly in a palace chamber. Where the Buddha was situated, it was spacious and beautifully adorned. Why would the Buddha present himself? Because being a Buddha, when you are a Buddha, you are your own environment, like as if you were in a dream. Everything is a kind of dream, in other words, when you're in the illusoriness of reality. You're like the moon reflected in different bodies of water everywhere. You and your reflection are the same. And so he suddenly enshrines himself in a palace chamber, like someone would meet an exalted emperor or king or something in the ordinary worldly way in ancient India, in some sort of tableau, you know, like on a stage. It's theatrical, you know, royalties and presidents and ministers, it's all theater, you know, and they're in this sort of theatrical thing in order for people to pay attention to them. They do that. So Buddha shows himself like that. Because he is the leader of the world. In fact, they are all our leaders of worlds, you know. And so then people orient themselves toward that, then they will orient themselves toward their own potential for freedom, is the idea. Unfortunately, the ordinary ruler tends to want to oppress people because they're feeling insecure about themselves if they're not enlightened. Whereas the one who is already a doorway of enlightenment because they are completely presenting themselves within the illusory world, within their own dream of life, they're presenting themselves in a playful manner, in a theatrical manner, a way in which another person can find their own exalted potential. Just like when we go to a great movie with a hero that we deeply admire, or a shiro that we deeply admire, we then feel somehow elevated by when we see them. You know, fashion world also works like that. The palace chamber in which the Buddha was situated was spacious and beautifully adorned. It extended throughout the 10 directions. It was made of jewels of various colors, and it was decorated with all kinds of precious flowers. The precious adornments emanated lights like clouds. The masses of their reflections from within the palace formed banners. A boundless host of enlightening beings, the congregation at the site of enlightenment, were all gathered there. By means of the ability to manifest the lights and inconceivable sounds of the Buddhas, they fashioned nets of the finest jewels from which came forth all the realms of action of the powers of the Buddhas, and in which were reflected images of the abodes of all beings. Also, by virtue of the aid of the spiritual power of the Buddha, they embraced the entire cosmos in a single thought. Their lion seat thrones were high, wide, and beautiful. The bases were made of jewels, their nets of lotus blossoms, their tableaus of pure, exquisite gemstones. They were adorned with various flowers of all colors. Their roofs, chambers, steps, and doors were adorned by the images of all things. The branches and fruits of jeweled trees surrounded them, arrayed at intervals. Clouds of radiance of jewels reflected each other. The Buddhas of the 10 directions conjured regal pearls, and the exquisite jewels in the topknots of all the enlightening beings all emanated light, which came and illuminated them. Furthermore, sustained by the power of all Buddhas, they expounded the vast perspective of the enlightened ones, their subtle tones extending afar, there being no place they did not reach. At that time, the Buddha, the world-honored one, in this setting, attained to supreme correct awareness of all things. His knowledge entered into all times with complete equanimity. His body filled all worlds. His voice universally accorded with all lands in the 10 directions. Like space which contains all forms, he made no discrimination among all objects. And as space extends everywhere, he entered all lands with equanimity. His body forever sat omnipresent in all sights of enlightenment. Among the host of enlightening beings, his awesome light shone clearly, like the sun emerging, illumining the world. The ocean of myriad virtues which he practiced in all times was thoroughly pure, and he constantly demonstrated the production of all the Buddha lands, their boundless forms and spheres of light extending throughout the entire cosmos equally and impartially. He expounded all truths like spreading great clouds. Each of his hair tips was able to contain all worlds without interference, in each manifesting immeasurable powers, teaching and civilizing all sentient beings. His body extended throughout the 10 directions, yet without coming or going. His knowledge entered into all forms and realized the emptiness of all things. All the miraculous displays of the Buddhas of past, present, and future were all seen in his light, and all the adornments of inconceivable aeons were revealed. Here, you know, here I should say, I think you can see behind me this amazing painting of the thousand-armed, thousand-eyed Avalokiteshvara, which is considered to be the an emanation of the infinite compassion of all Buddhas. And this, he has thousand eyes of a thousand Buddhas of this world aeon, of this kind of planetary system that we're in. And because this Shakyamuni Buddha was only the fourth out of a thousand, so there's 995 to go over next millions of years. And millions of years. So don't worry. You know, we're going to meet the challenge of the climate and so on. As humans, not without humans. We will meet it. And then the thousand eyes are the presence of all Buddhas. But this vision that is conveyed in this time of the Buddha's first days of enlightenment is actually the way things are already. So, for example, right now, although we're sitting in a room on Earth, in New York State, in America, blah, blah, in the Catskill Mountains, in a hidden valley, Magic Valley, we are have this kind of beings all around us are here from other dimensions. They're completely with us. And they are really happy whenever our mind turns, when we're about to lose our temper or break something or hurt someone or do something silly or hurt ourselves. They are like trying to stop us, help us, prevent us, but they can't control us. We have to control ourselves. But they are all there with us to help. There's infinite helpful energies all around us, all the time. But they're just showing themselves now because it's the time of the Buddha's first enjoyment of enjoying being in this freedom that he's been seeking since beginningless time, only to discover that he's always been there. But time also is illusory, and he's always been there. So it's kind of an amazing moment. Okay? So then these are the beings around him. There were great enlightening beings, numerous as the atoms in 10 Buddha worlds, surrounding him. Oh yeah, I should say emptiness. Now emptiness, don't think emptiness means nothingness, or voidness, as I prefer than emptiness. But anyway, emptiness is fine. This emptiness, or openness, you could say, doesn't mean nothingness. It's a relational term. You know, when a door is open, in a way, that means that there's no door there. So the idea of a doorway has become nothing. So you can walk through the door. But the openness is not nothingness. It's a space through which you can enter. Nothingness would not be there at all. You couldn't enter that, you see. So emptiness is very different from nothingness. And all emptiness means is that all things are empty of any non-relative thing, element or component. So there's nothing to block you in among all things. And there's no essence or core, you know, immovable and substantial and intrinsically real out of its own substance thing in anything. And for example, your own identity, something that seems to say the same within you, is something that you just maintain. The feeling that it's the same, but there's nothing that's the same in you. You're completely changing all the time. Materialists help us understand that, in that all they think, but unfortunately what they have done is they've made the nothing of no fixed thing in there to be something. Because their habit of having something that's still the essence of whatever it is, that's got to be the thing you grab onto. So what they grab onto, unfortunately, is nothingness. Which means they're slightly cuckoo. Because nothing can't grab nothing, and nothing can't be grabbed by something, because nothing is nothing. So therefore it's not there, okay? So it's just the habit of trying to make it something that you think you can hold on to, that makes them hold on to nothing. Their fear of being purely interrelational is what emptiness helps overcome. And therefore, as someone who hears emptiness, you can also translate emptiness as freedom. And believe it or not, some people are scared of freedom. And they want a boss or something, you know, they want someone to control them or put them in a place, and then they feel they're happier to be trapped there than to be free. Because they're afraid of it. They think there might be terrible things going on there. So in freedom, you know, freedom would mean they wouldn't know what's going on or something. Whereas freedom, of course, is bliss. That's when our bliss is allowed. That's when we discover our bliss, is when we're in freedom. You know, and we are in freedom, actually. Okay, anyway. Numerous as the atoms in 10 Buddha worlds surrounding him. Buddha worlds means universes. Buddhaverse, everything. What seems to the people in it as if it's everything. There is no such thing that's everything. Infinity means beyond everything. But that's where we are, it's infinity, actually. But on the other hand, infinity is just a negation of finitude. So saying we're in it kind of is meaningless because it's us also, but never mind that. There were great enlightening beings numerous as the atoms in 10 Buddha worlds surrounding him. Their names were universally good Bodhisattva, Shiro, Enlightenment Shiro, Samantabhadra. This Samantabhadra is the great Bodhisattva of this Flower Ornament Sutra. You know, there's Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, Vajrapani, all kinds of Bodhisattvas. There's especially a number of set of 8 great ones. But among them, Samantabhadra is the special one here. And his specialty, and I think we'll stop with that, we'll probably leave this first session discussing a little bit Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra's specialty is that he is aware that he is reflected in infinite other dimensions at the same time as wherever he is. And he's a he and she, he can be a she too. Samantabhadra, you just add an ah at the end. And then that's the name of a female. And so he's beyond male and female in a way, let's say. But anyway, we're saying he, that's what they are saying. And he has a male form. And so he, like right now, if I was Samantabhadra, I would be aware that there's infinite me's in infinite worlds, in every atom and subatomic particle in this environment that I'm perceiving around me, and in every molecule and hair tip and pore of my body, and every atom and molecule, whatever, and subatomic particle in my own body, there's more me's. And whatever I'm doing is repeating itself in all of those things, in all of those different worlds and dimensions. And therefore, it's all good, because I don't want to see any bad thing repeated, because I'm infinitely aware that everything I do is being repeated. It's like Nietzsche. You know, the great Nietzsche said this thing about don't ever do anything in life that you wouldn't be willing to repeat infinitely forever. What's called the eternal return. You know, his eternal recurrence. He had this kind of aestheticization of Kant's idea of the categorical imperative, in fact, about ethical things. But anyway, he said, everything you do, you should be willing to redo it infinitely. So it should only, like if you make a gesture, it should be the pleasure of that gesture, the beauty of that gesture in its context, in regard to whatever other person, what they would see from the gesture, that you and they would enjoy it so much that you'd be willing to keep seeing it forever. That's his ideal. And so Samantabhadra lives in an eternal recurrence in the minute, in the moment, and in every atom, and in every place it's recurring, consciously present in all of them. And therefore he's Samantabhadra, all, some totally, anta means to the limit, Bhadra means good. So he's always totally good. Samantabhadra. That's a really wonderful Bodhisattva. And his specialty, he's always popping up here and there in this sutra. And his thing is the specialty of this sutra. So if you say a mantra, or if you do a good thing, or you open a door for an elderly person going through, or you help anybody in any way, or you do something good about yourself, you finally overcome some particularly bad habit, you quit smoking, or quit drinking, or quit whatever, looking askance at people, or whatever it is, you simultaneously do it infinitely. And that makes it totally good, all around good. Okay? And when you're aware that everything you do is like that, you get like really on your toes about goodness. Okay? And luckily you discover that that is the effortless way of being anyway. So when we end any session that we end, we must dedicate the merit, the goodness, talk about Samantabhadra, of whatever we did toward the welfare of all beings. And the true welfare of all beings from our own perspectives is when we become Buddhas. Because then we become their welfare. We become their happiness. We become their freedom. We become their release from suffering. Because that becomes our automatic effort. And not that they necessarily immediately will experience it. Because to them, they're stuck in this flow of time. And they each take their own time, you know. But from our point of view, because we're present in all times. When you become a Buddha, you're also every moment of the future, as well as every moment of the past. You realize you are always Buddha, and you realize that all beings already are Buddha, and then you realize that there will be a time within the illusory level of where they think they are, when they will realize that they are Buddha. They will break past that illusion, and they will see, they will within the illusory be Buddha. You could say the non-duality of the illusion and reality will disappear for them. And they will be Buddha in all space and all time. Like you are. And your own presence in doing that will be effortless to them. So every little good thing that we do within our relative thing, like we read a few page or two from the Flower Ornament Sutra, we listen to that, we try to expand and imagine it, we try to meditate it, and we dedicate the merit that we got from that, or whatever we got out of it, toward the completeness of happiness for all, becoming a Buddha for the sake of all beings, toward our bodhisattva vow, you could say. All right? So we hereby dedicate the merit, may we quickly become a Buddha for the sake of all living beings and their final fulfillment. Okay? Thank you.